You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back if you're rejoining us, and happy Wednesday afternoon. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Well, this hour is for you, ladies and gentlemen. I've got an amazing friend of the show, an expert on our legal system, our partisan divide, our political processes, and yes, the C word, corruption. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Howard Schwaber. Welcome back to the program, Howard.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back. Folks, if you've got a question for Howard or I, you want to call out what your favorite corruption scandal might be and get our reactions to it, the phone and text lines are open, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Let's start with one, Howard, that is literally in the news today. And this is a fascinating one to me because the idea that a congressperson, whether on the Senate or House side, a president, a vice president, a head of an executive branch agency, could ever own stock, be it directly or in an indirect ownership structure like a mutual fund, where they can own stock of a company or have a business interest that is subject to the jurisdiction of that particular elected official or cabinet level secretary or director or president or vice president seems insane to me. It is a direct conflict of interest that creates all sorts of perverse incentives. And in the last 20 to 25 years, there has been case after case after case, Democrats and Republicans, where congresspeople in particular, we can talk about presidents specifically, but I'm just going to focus on congresspersons right now, have seemingly traded on information available to them only by virtue of their role as an elected official. Perhaps most notably, there was a fairly significant scandal that came about in the wake of the COVID-19 global pandemic. I'm not going to get into the particulars of who is alleged to do some trading, and there's been legislation trying to address this that most ethics watchdogs thinks is woefully inadequate. It basically has very little penalty if they're ever levied. The penalties are de minimis. It's mostly a disclosure rule. It gets ignored all the time. The disclosures are often inadequate. And certain senators have been trying to do something about it. I rarely agree with Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, but he's trying to do something about it. He's brought back legislation that was voted on today by a Senate committee that has advanced out of that committee. And interestingly enough, Wisconsin's own Ron Johnson was sitting on that committee and took a vote. What Senator Hawley's, and this is bipartisan legislation, attempts to do is in fact ban direct stock ownership by members of Congress of companies that are subject to the committee jurisdiction on which congresspeople sit. It also bans direct stock ownership by presidents and vice presidents. But after this one, we'll get into a little bit of that later. But Ron Johnson can't seem to find his way to support some of what I would call the most basic conflict of interest avoidance laws like this one. Here's Ron Johnson explaining to all of us Wisconsinites why he thinks it should be okay for congresspeople to basically earn money based on their insider information from the horse's mouth itself. Let's take a listen to the senator.
We make it very unattractive for people to step up to the plate and run for office or potentially serve in office. I tried hiring a retired CFO many years ago. This after the passage of the Stock Act. Would have been great. I could have had somebody really expert in international taxation, that type of thing. I could not find anybody willing to do it. So this piece of legislation, really, it's legislative demagoguery. You know, we do have insider trading laws. We have financial disclosure. Trust me, we have financial disclosure. The press pays attention to it. So I don't see the necessity of this. I can imagine all kinds of unintended consequences. You could relabel this law, quite honestly, the Career Politician Protection Act. because it'll make it so unattractive for people to give up their business, sell it, unless some ethics committee says, oh, no, there won't be a conflict of interest. I mean, there's when we pass a tax law that lowers tax rates, we all benefit. It's just an inherent issue. So, again, we have plenty of protections. We have the disclosure. This is a completely unnecessary piece of legislation. It's going to create all kinds of unintended consequences. Senator Scott just pointed out one of them, just one of them. So, again, I voted no last time. I'm a strong no this time, even stronger this time.
Oh, I have my thoughts, but, Professor, I'll give it to you for the first shots at that comment from Ron Johnson.
While I respect the senator's concerns, imagine if a general in the Air Force who were in charge of approving contracts for new jets owned stock in Lockheed. That is a made-up example. I don't mean to disparage either Lockheed or any general in the Air Force. I think there's sort of three levels to this. At a deep philosophical level, Johnson and others seem not to think that there's a difference between being a private business CEO and being a member of Congress or of the Senate. That public and private are indistinguishable, and that the ethics involved are indistinguishable, and the obligations are indistinguishable. I think it's insane and unwholesome, but if I had to give a name to what's gone wrong in American politics in the last 20 years, that would be a pretty good start, honestly. At a slightly more less philosophical, more concrete level, it is absurd to suggest this law that he is opposing doesn't go nearly far enough.
Right.
I can't own stock if the stock is regulated by my committee, but if I'm on that committee, I can share information with another senator who can then buy the stock. I do not understand why there is not. I'm sorry, cynically, I do. It would seem to me highly desirable that all members of Congress put all of their assets in a blind trust upon taking office. And the third piece, that we can't attract people. I mean, this is his big complaint. We'll never get people to serve in Congress if they can't get rich doing so, is disturbing. I spent some time in Pakistan, and one of the most interesting conversations, I had a lot of interesting conversations in Pakistan, but one of them had to do with people serving in the military. And the people, just the folks I was talking to, were shocked when I explained to them that in the United States, being in a senior military position is not the obvious way to amass great wealth. They assume that anyone who's a senior military officer becomes very, very rich by doing so. I think there's an analogy here. And there are lots of places in the world where serving in Congress is a way to get really, really rich. We've never really wanted to think about the United States as one of them, let alone, you know, based on what is either illegal or borderline illegal practices. Final comment before I give you back the mic. You were exactly right when you said this is bipartisan. This cuts across both parties. It's gone on for decades. It's gotten much worse, I think, in the last 20 years or so. And it's long, we are long overdue for some house cleaning. And if I can borrow a phrase, it's time to drain the swamp a little.
Yes, we'll get into the use of that phrase and its impacts and the way that it gets interpreted or misinterpreted in many ways. But this to me is as simple as if you hold elected office at the federal level, or you are a cabinet secretary, or you basically have contracting authority that is at a certain level, should be pretty basic. You cannot own individual stocks. Those that you do and wish to continue to own must be in a blind trust, and you cannot sell them while you have that seat. In other words, you have to hold the stocks until you leave office. The idea that banning conflicts of interest or banning the abuse, the leverage that is given to Congress people because of their access to information to enrich themselves, that advantages incumbents and would prevent otherwise qualified people from running for Congress is so absurd and stupid on its face that it need not be rebutted. The problem with incumbency is the two-party system and a whole bunch of other things and campaign finance issues. This idea that qualified people will refuse to serve if they can't get rich doing so should be so offensive to regular Americans. I continue to be amazed at what Ron Johnson gets away with saying, frankly, because he says it with a whole heck of a lot of derision, I think, and certitude. But Memo Ron, being in government is not supposed to make you rich. It shouldn't impoverish you. Like, the opposite shouldn't be true. But this idea that you must be entitled to some level of enrichment is simply beyond the pale. This is, again, one of those things. Doesn't matter who polls, when they poll, or whom they poll. Americans understand that if you are a person in Congress and you have committee jurisdiction, and you shouldn't be able to enrich yourself based on that inside information or share it or leak it in any other way, and that transparency rules alone don't get it done. You need to ban the practice, and it should extend, of course, to the president and vice president. We've got Jack from Merrimack on the line. Jack, say hello to Howard. What's your question or comment, sir?
Well, yeah, okay. Hi, Howard.
Hi, Jack.
My comment is, don't say that in an airport.
That's the old Dick Gregory joke.
My comment is that I've read that there's something like between $3 and $4 trillion of so-called unrealized but very real income that it remains untaxed. And of course, the argument will be, well, it's completely legal. Yeah. The question is, I'm paying taxes on my income. Should that be legal to hide anywhere near that kind of money? Second thing is, I've also read that there's something close to $200 billion annually in income taxes, mostly from the very rich, that goes uncollected. And something should be probably be done about that. So those are the main things. The third thing I've read is that if we tax wealth of $30 million and above at a progressive rate, starting at 2% and hitting 5% at a billion, we could raise something between $1 and $2 trillion annually, and we wouldn't run out of money because there are all constantly people that would be going into those categories.
Jack, I'm going to have to hop in. We're going to save those questions. Two basic subjects in Jack's question. The tax code is deeply unfair because it leaves untaxed the wealth of the mega, mega, mega rich, the folks with names on their buildings. And second of all, does that indicate that we've got system-wide corruption that is pernicious and difficult to eradicate? We continue this discussion with Professor Howard Schwaber on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Go back, folks. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You ever wonder what I talk with our very smart guests about during the breaks? Well, that's the show behind the show, the secret show, if you will. You want to hear all of the discussion and miss none of it, you can always watch this program on Civic Media's YouTube channel or at Maggie Dawn Show on Instagram, X, and Facebook. You can also find me on Blue Sky. I sometimes post some missives, some off-the-cuff thoughts on the day's news. So please do follow and like on those platforms. Great question that we got from our good friend Jack from Merrimack before the break, and that was about tax policy generally, which we talk about on this program a lot, And the fact that if we look at the U.S. tax policy and, frankly, our tax brackets, how we tax capital gains, how we tax estates worth more than $25 million, and we look at how that has changed over the last 50 years. So I'm going to say from Richard Nixon onwards into our modern tax environment, what you've seen is not a tax code and tax system that is placing or working to place more burden on those with ultra mega wealth. In fact, we've seen our tax policy become more regressive. In other words, shifting government funding obligations more and more to the middle class. And that includes people who save and work and contribute to their 401ks and might have a couple of million in that retirement account. They've shifted a lot of the funding burden for government onto middle class people and upper middle class people. In other words, we've seen, again, a more regressive approach to taxation over the last 50 years. I would say, not coincidentally, Howard, over that same period of time, the net worth of the individuals that establish our tax code, meaning the representatives in Congress, in the House and the Senate, their average net worth over that 50-year period of time, adjusted for inflation, has gone up markedly over that period. In fact, we're going to include a link to a couple of sources of data on that in our show notes today. You can find that, folks, again, at civicmedia.us, anywhere you find the podcast of The Maggie Dawn Show. But, for example, in 2011, the average net worth of a sitting U.S. senator, and it's worse now, by the way, the average net worth was $14 million. No kidding that the tax code will benefit people that have a lot of money. Howard, at a very high level, is this a version of corruption of some sort?
It is, but look, that's disturbing, but it's different from what we were talking about before.
Yes.
Before, we were talking about essentially insider trading, which is, among other things, a crime. This is, you know, sort of, there's a distinction that is drawn between legal corruption and illegal corruption. Let me use our own state of Wisconsin as an example. There was a time when Wisconsin's state Supreme Court and our court system in general was regarded as a model of clean, good government, ethical, high standards. And then things changed in the late 2000s. And that's a whole long conversation. And not long after that, not long after the election of a couple of justices in particular, one of whom is named Gableman, for example, who just surrendered his law license for 3 years, the Sofra Center for Ethics at Harvard did a study and determined that Wisconsin has one of the highest levels of legal corruption of any court system in the country. Now, legal corruption is not people in parking garages exchanging suitcases full of money. Legal corruption is the term that is used to describe a situation where interest groups, the most wealthy, the most powerful, have excessive and untoward influence on policymaking and outcomes to the degree that it's corrupt in the sense that it's no longer the case that the government is representing and serving people, the people. It is rather a tool for maximizing the interests of certain specific groups or interests. In that broader sense of the term, yeah, this is absolutely corruption.
Yes. How do we, looking at court systems and the legal system in particular, and frankly, the fact that Americans' confidence in our legal system and the courts has simply bottomed. I mean, it is, the bottom has fallen out. The judicial branch, according to current polling, is at its lowest approval ratings since we started polling for these things many decades ago. What do we do, especially in the court system, to try to fix that corruption? Because it's not that hard when you're dealing with the court system, or at least it shouldn't be.
Oh, it's actually harder in many ways.
Good. Well, tell me.
In order to try and prevent corruption in the court system, in the federal courts, we, at the very founding of the country, adopted lifetime appointments. Think of the fact that Donald Trump appointed 3 Supreme Court justices. It feels like every exchange we have, I end up saying, we could do a whole show on the Supreme Court. But I think the loss of confidence in the court is warranted, and I think it's because of exactly this version of corruption that I'm talking about. No one thinks that John Roberts is taking bribes in a back room in an envelope with dollar bill stuff in it. But I think lots of observers, maybe even most observers, think that John Roberts has sold out his obligations, his duties, and the integrity of his institution to support the people he favors.
Mm. At base, the appearance of impropriety and its ability to erode public trust in institutions, I think, in turn, greases the skids or makes an environment where additional indirect corruption or influence peddling can happen even more, Howard. In other words, people look at the system and they say, oh, it's rotten, and so it's not so bad if I participate in some of this rottenness because this is the state of play. Is there kind of a spiraling or cascading impact of this sort of corruption? We're going to discuss that more with my special guest, Professor Emeritus from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Howard Schwaber. Will continue to take your calls and texts. Thanks to John from Oshkosh texting in on the WISS text line. You can get in those questions now, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. We're going to talk about how corruption impacts your day-to-day life. We're going to eventually talk about what we can all do about it. On the other side, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Wednesday afternoon to you one and all. Got a great guest with me this hour. He is Professor Emeritus from UW-Madison, Howard Schwaber. We're talking about corruption and its varying forms. I'd like to ask you this question. I got this question earlier today on the text line from one of our friends, our conservative friends, Mark from Sussex. And he said, oh, well, if you're talking about corruption, you have to talk about the Steele dossier and the corruption around Burisma and the Bidens. Setting aside the factual accuracy or inaccuracy of any of those claims, what I thought it presented, Howard, was a really interesting opportunity to talk about different types of corruption and the impacts of different types of corruption. In other words, not all corruption is created equal, and not all corruption has the same kind of impact, especially impact on people's everyday lives. I just wanted to get your thinking on this, and you can address it in any way you'd like. And folks, you've got a question for Howard or I, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC.
So, yeah, I know. I think it's a really good point. I'll extend it a little bit. There's both different kinds of corruption or forms, and degree matters. So yes. A lot of the things that Trump is doing that people complain about, he will say and has said, look, people have been doing this all along. I'm just doing it more. Or more effectively. And there's some truth to that. You can tolerate in the system a certain low level of corruption. If you play hardball, if you not restrain yourself at all and push it to its maximum, the problem is you risk destabilizing the whole thing. And I think that's one version of what's going on here. But the reference to the Steele dossier and other such controversies is a nice one, right? So one kind of dishonesty or corruption, if you like, is political hardball and dirty tricks. Mm-hmm. And those matter. They matter in that they help certain people get elected or keep other people from being elected. And of course, that has enormous consequences. We're talking about a different kind of corruption, I think, where we're talking about the process of lawmaking and policymaking. That is the government as opposed to the politics, electoral politics, right? One is how you get to be in government. One is what you do once you're there. And if in government, you act with that same kind of hardball, anything goes, dishonest approach to things. That's much, much more destructive. If you go back to 2016, when Trump was running for president for the first time, he was challenged on the fact that it seemed pretty clear he hadn't paid taxes for several years. And he said, of course he didn't, I'm smart. And what he meant was, he's a businessman, and it is the role of a businessman to maximize advantage, to take advantage of the rules and game the system as much as possible, and even to cheat if everyone else is cheating in order to keep the playing field level, right? You hear people sometimes in business say, I have to cheat, my competitors do. I have no choice. It's the rejection of unilateral disarmament. If you bring that same ethos into government, though, that's corrupt in a deep sense. That's corrupt in the sense that the Romans used the word. The loss of virtue, the loss of a sense of any risk. Res publica, the word republic, yes, comes from the idea that there is a public thing, res publica, something that is not the same as private interest and is not done in the same way as private interest. So this goes back to my very earliest comment, but A, I think the comment's a good one and points out that various forms of corruption are bipartisan, again, leaving aside the factual validity of any particular allegation. But B, there's something really different about, let's call it ordinary criminality and real corruption, which is distorting the purpose and the values of government. And to my mind, that last one is much, much more dangerous and much worse and much, much harder to fix.
Folks, again, if you, like Mark from Sussex, have a comment or a question, you can reach Howard and I at 855-752-4842-855-75-CIVIC. Let me ask this question differently, and maybe your answer is somewhat, you know, see above what you just said. It seems to me that Donald Trump and his allies, both within government and outside of government, have made a never-ending laundry list of allegations of corruption against others. Yes. And some of that perhaps is meritorious. Some of it perhaps is just made up, you know, garbage. But what I think has happened is that what is corruption and the matter of degree, its risk and its impact on people's lives has sort of receded from the conversation. And now it's oh, well, you're claiming my guy did this and it was corrupt, but your guy or gal did X, Y, Z. And we've lost a shared reference point of what is and is not acceptable. And I'm going to point to the Senate's confirmation of Emile Beauvais yesterday to a federal judgeship on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. This is Donald Trump's personal defense, criminal defense lawyer. There were three whistleblowers that came out and said some variety of he lied in his Senate questionnaire related to his nomination. He incorrectly purged people from the Department of Justice because they refused to engage in what those attorneys considered to be politically motivated prosecutions, and or he mishandled the Eric Adams, mayor of New York, corruption case itself, corruption upon corruption. The Senate blew past those three whistleblowers and the third whistleblower and confirmed this guy that even the most conservative lawyers belonging to the Federalist Society and many Republican-appointed Article III judges said this guy is utterly unfit. There are conflicts of interest, and he is himself corrupt. So my question to you, Howard, is have we lost the distinction or a shared understanding of what is the corruption that we as regular people in our American democracy need to be most gravely concerned about?
I think we absolutely have. And you know, I'll use a very old phrase, defining deviancy down, a phrase that goes way back to the 1960s. There are several bits of this. One is in a hyperpartisan atmosphere, people are perfectly willing to accept the possibility their opponents are corrupt, but not their own guy. And so it ceases to be a neutral, it ceases to be a standard that you hold your own people to. It's only a weapon you use against other people, which is a loss. Secondly, as you pointed out, and this is something Trump does more than I think anyone has ever done before on the presidential stage, but it's not in itself new. If you throw out enough reckless accusations, one of the things that it does is it insulates you against accusations, even if they're based on truth, because there's just fog. It's Steve Bannon has a phrase for this, which is too crude to say on the radio, but flooding the zone with, let's call it, distraction.
Yes.
And that's a strategy, but it's a strategy that has the result, you know, sort of like our loss of belief in science and our loss of trust in institutions. There's a loss of belief that anybody could ever be not corrupt. And if you assume that all politicians are always corrupt, then you'll choose your corrupt guy rather than the other corrupt guy you don't like. Donald Trump, Gulf states have put $2 billion into cybercurrency businesses in which Donald Trump has a direct interest and his family has ownership interest. And it's almost the case that no one is raising an eyebrow. That would have been mind-boggling 30 years ago, 25 years ago, you know, when did we cross a line where somehow that's not worthy of comment? It's a really good question and a tough one. And I don't think you can blame one person for it, but certainly Trump is taking advantage of this shift with both hands on a shovel.
Yes. It doesn't avoid comment on this program. And in fact, tomorrow, folks, we're going to break down cryptocurrencies with an expert in crypto, explaining what they are, the different kinds of them, how they operate, what they can be used, the purposes for which they can be used for good, and also some of the corruption possibilities that come with crypto. And we'll be joined in the second hour tomorrow by former White House ethics counsel for George W. Bush, Richard Painter. Richard Painter was one of the founding members and leaders of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CRU. We're going to talk to him about exactly that corruption, the use of Donald Trump's stablecoin in a transaction of billions of dollars worth by a sovereign wealth fund in the Mideast, in the Gulf states. That's not to mention the fact that Jared Kushner got some $20 billion from the Saudi sovereign wealth fund right after his father-in-law left the White House the first time for his hedge fund, even though the guy had no experience running a hedge fund. I digress. Very specific instance. Folks, if you've got a question or comment for Howard and I, 855-752-4842. Carmela from Milwaukee, say hello to Howard. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Howard. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Carmela.
Hi. It's more a comment or maybe a question. I listened this afternoon to, I think it's Rick Wilson of the Lincoln Project, and he was talking basically about corruption from the Republicans. And I don't think he used the word gerrymandering, but he was warning about redistricting, say the word, and about specifically Texas and California. And if we don't, meaning the Democrats, fight like the Republicans do, they're going to take over again, and they're never going to go out of power again. And I'm confused by that, but it kind of goes along the lines of what you're talking about with corruption and maybe how to fight it or why people are doing it and so on and so forth. Do you have any comments on that?
Great question, Carmela. Howard, go ahead.
Please. Right. So a perfect example. Gerrymandering is, first of all, a really good form of a certain kind of corruption of the principle, you know, not financial corruption. It's dishonest. It's sleazy. The U.S. Supreme Court has blessed it, saying that essentially they said, well, it's all part of the game. What can you do anyway? As long as one party engages in gerrymandering, the other party will say, well, we have to also engage in gerrymandering, because otherwise you're talking about unilateral disarmament and the bad guys win. This goes deep. And the fundamental thing, and Wisconsin is a great place to start this conversation, until Wisconsin Republican voters get tired of dirty tricks and dishonesty from Republican candidates, and Wisconsin Democratic voters get tired of dishonesty and dirty tricks from Democratic candidates, until voters hold their own parties accountable, there is no effective way to fight against minimally legal corruption, because it's the Oakland Raiders motto, just win, baby.
Just win, baby. It doesn't, and let me be clear, Carmela, I'll respond to your question and Rick Wilson's comments directly. What Texas is proposing to do is re-gerrymander all of their U.S. congressional districts to eliminate the possibility that Texas would have a single Democratic congressperson elected to the House of Representatives. Why are they considering doing so? Because the margins come 2026 in the House of Representatives are going to be, again, razor, razor thin. This is having a cascading race to the bottom potential impact. If Republicans do it in Texas, then it is open season. And this means, again, part of the problem is the two parties. Part of the problem is the primary system. Part of the problem is the lack of ranked choice voting or top five primary voting. But all of this, this permissive structure, if they do it, we do it, we'll do it worse or better, depending on your perspective. What it does is it robs centrists and people of good faith of having their vote count. I believe in one person and one vote, and elected officials that actually represent all of their constituents, not the select few. We continue this discussion on the other side. Join us, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-75-CIVIC.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. And welcome. Happy Hump Day. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My next guest is not just a lawyer and a political scholar, but a Merle Haggard fan, and that just makes him all the much more fun to speak with. He is Howard Schwaber, professor emeritus at UW-Madison. We're talking about corruption, its modern forms, and where it all might be taking us. You've got one segment left to get in your comments and questions, 855-752-4842. Howard, in the break, we were talking about the fact that Wisconsin really has been the petri dish for what some of what we're calling legalized corruption, including gerrymandering. And it seems to me we have entered it, we have sort of gone through the looking glass with the second Trump administration. And there are, it's almost every day in the news, there's another headline about what I think most people, if we're speaking in good faith, would call something that looks pretty corrupt happening in real time, except it's happening in the bright light of day. It's headlines. And we've started to, at least some folks have started to accept these instances of legalized corruption, which really make government unresponsive to the needs and the demands of the vast majority of Wisconsinites and Americans. They're excusing it because, hey, it's my part, it's my team winning, and so that's okay. We can win by any means necessary. The ends justify the means. And so it seems like we're entering into this era of normalized and accepted corruption. And my question to you, sir, is what outcomes can we expect over the long term if this is now the norm?
Oh, we know exactly what this looks like from governments in Latin America and Eastern Europe. We know, I mean, this is one of the ways democracies fail. And I think it's premature to say the United States democracy is on the road to, is on the verge of failure. But, you know, if you extend the trend lines out, it certainly doesn't look good. And this is a big one, because when you know, I remember when Dick Cheney, while vice president, was asked about deficits, which at the time were a very big deal in American politics. And he said, oh, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. What he meant by that was Reagan proved that it's not harmful to the party and the candidate's political future to run up big deficits, not that they don't really matter to the world or the future of the economy. That's what corruption feels like now. That Trump has proved that corruption doesn't matter. A candidate, a president, a party is not hurt by being tarred by corruption as long as it's only by their enemies, because it's just so normal and so dismissed and so accepted. And the long-term consequences of that is that it's not just a loss of a middle. There ceases to be any basis for trust in the institutions or the system at all. Loyalty, you know, it's a phrase, but it can become a reality. Party above country. That can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm. Because at a certain point, there ceases to be a meaningful sort of country to which to feel attached. If you honestly think that everybody involved is cheating, everybody involved is only out to benefit for themselves and does not care about you. To take one example, Trump gave an interview quite recently where he essentially said he believes he's the president of the people who voted for him, mm-hmm. rather than for all of the Americans. If people internalize that sense, right, then there's really nothing to attach to. And we'll stop asking whether people think institutions are legitimate. We'll start asking whether they are really institutions at all. I know I'm being kind of apocalyptic, but, you know, these are big trends that can have apocalyptic outcomes and historically have done so in other places. As for what we can do about it, I think, you know, there's one giant message that I wish I could drum into the heads of everyone I ever meet, which is it doesn't have to be this way. It wasn't always this way. It doesn't have. This is not a natural order of things or an inevitable order of things. It doesn't have to be this way. And if people can conceive of that as a possibility, then I think they'll be somewhat less willing to say, look, I hate the corruption, I hate the viciousness, I hate the line, but I want secure borders, or but I want welfare payments, or but I want national, whatever is the thing that you care about. and accepting all this other stuff is the only way to get the policies that I like. That's not true, but that's the menu that the American electorate is being offered. And so that's what has to change. Exactly how to do that, if I knew that, I'd be really in demand.
Yes. Do you think some of the answer lies in what I'm going to call democracy process reforms? That is, you know, things like first five primary voting and ranked choice voting and multi-member districts and independent redistricting committees and actually beefing up our transparency and disclosure laws about campaign contributions. Those sorts of things that when explained correctly to folks, are broadly appealing to people.
Absolutely. But I really come back to one just over and over, the gerrymander. I'm not sure you can overstate how much damage that has done. Without going into the history, I think many people know this, but it's worth repeating. Because the vast majority of congressional districts are party safe districts. You know in advance which party they're going to go for. The only dispute is who's going to win in the primary to be that party's candidate. That has pushed members of Congress in both parties to positions that are much more extreme than those held even by their own voters. If you look at national polling data, Americans have broad areas of agreement, and where we disagree, even when we disagree strongly, it's not nearly as sharp as the disagreements we see among our political representatives. There's a distorting mechanism in place that doesn't just incentivize, it requires ideological extremism. If we wanted to fix one structural thing, start with that.
Start with that. We need competitive districts. We need to stop the gerrymander. In fact, Law Forward has brought a lawsuit in this state challenging the anti-competitiveness of our legislative districts. I call myself a radical centrist for exactly this reason. We need to bring common sense back to politics. And my guest today, Professor Emeritus Howard Schwaber, you always bring some of that common sense to our discussion. Thank you so much, sir. And thank you to each and every one of you for listening. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it is always better when we stand together.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.